Chapter 14. André Durand was honestly incensed. "Well, there's no working with you any more," he declared. Ravitch shrugged his shoulders. He had learned from Weber that Durand was to receive 10,000 francs for the operation. Unless he arranged with him in advance how much he was to get, Durand would send him only 200 francs. That's what he had done last time.
"Half an hour before the operation. I would never have thought it of you, Dr. Ravitch."
"Neither would I," Ravitch said.
"You know you can always rely on my generosity. I don't understand why you are so businesslike now. At the very moment when the patient knows that we have his life in our hands, it is painful for me to talk about money."
"It isn't for me," Ravitch replied. Durand looked at him for a while. His wrinkled face with the white goatee expressed dignity and indignation. He adjusted his gold-rimmed pince-nez.
"How much were you thinking of?" he asked reluctantly.
2,000 francs.
"What?"
Durand looked as though he had been shot and could not yet believe it.
"Ridiculous,"
he then said briefly. "All right," Ravitch replied. "You can easily find someone else. Take Bino. He is excellent." He reached for his coat and put it on. Durand stared at him. His dignified face labored.
"Wait a minute," he said when Ravitch picked up his hat. "You can't let me down like that. Why didn't you tell me this yesterday?"
"Yesterday you were in the country, and I could not reach you."
2,000 francs. Do you know that even I won't ask that much? The patient is a friend of mine whom I can only charge for my expenses."
Durand looked like the Heavenly Father in a child's book. He was 70 years old, a fairly good diagnostician, but a poor surgeon. His excellent practice had been based mainly on the work of his former assistant, Bino, who, 2 years ago, had finally succeeded in making himself independent. Since that time, Durand had engaged Ravitch for his more difficult operations. Ravitch was known for making the smallest incisions and working in such a fashion that hardly any scar was left. Durand was an excellent connoisseur of Bordeaux wines, a favourite guest at elegant parties, and his patients came mostly from there.
"If I had known that," he murmured.
He had always known it. That was why before important operations he remained for 1 or 2 days in his house in the country. He wanted to avoid talking about the price before the operation. Afterwards it was simpler. Then he could hold out hopes for the next time. And then the next time it was the same thing. This time, to the astonishment of Durand, instead of coming in at the last moment, Ravitch had arrived 30 minutes before the appointed time for the operation, and so had got hold of him before the patient was anesthetized. There was no possibility of using this as a reason for breaking off the discussion. The nurse put her head through the open door.
"Shall we begin the anesthetic, Professor?"
Durand looked at her, then imploringly and compassionately at Ravitch. Ravitch answered his look compassionately but firmly.
"What do you think, Dr. Ravitch?"
"The decision rests with you, Professor."
"Just a minute, nurse. We do not yet see the procedure quite clearly."
The nurse withdrew. Durand turned toward Ravitch.
"Now what?"
he asked reproachfully. Ravitch put his hands in his pockets. "Postpone the operation until tomorrow, or for an hour, and take Bino." Bino had performed almost all of Durand's operations for 20 years, and had made no headway because Durand had systematically cut him off from almost all chance of becoming independent, and had always characterized him as a better-class underling. He hated Durand, and would demand at least 5,000 francs. Ravitch knew that much. Durand knew it, too.
"Dr. Ravitch," he said, "our profession shouldn't be involved in this sort of business discussion."
"I agree with you."
"Why don't you leave it to my discretion to settle this matter? Haven't you always been satisfied up to now?"
"Never," Ravitch said.
"You never told me that."
"Because it wouldn't have done any good. Besides, I wasn't very much interested. This time I am interested. I need the money." The nurse came in again.
"The patient is restless, Professor."
Durand stared at Ravitch. Ravitch stared back. It was difficult to get money from a Frenchman, that he knew, more difficult than from a Jew. A Jew sees the transaction, a Frenchman only the money he is going to hand out.
"One minute, nurse," Durand said. "Take the pulse, blood pressure, and temperature."
"I have done that."
"Well, then start the anesthetic."
The nurse left.
"All right, then," Durand said. I'll give you 1,000.
2,000, Ravitch corrected him. Durand did not consent. He stroked his goatee.
Well, listen, Ravitch, he said then with warmth. As a refugee who isn't allowed to practice...
I should not perform any operations for you, Ravitch interrupted him calmly. Now he expected to hear the traditional comment that he ought to be grateful to be tolerated in the country. But Durand forewent that. He could see that he wasn't getting anywhere, and time pressed.
2,000, he said bitterly, as if each word were a banknote fluttering out of his throat. I'll have to pay it out of my own pocket. I thought you would remember what I've done for you.
He waited. Strange, Ravitch thought, that bloodsuckers like to moralize. This old cheat with the rosette of the Legion of Honor in his buttonhole reproaches me for being exploited by him instead of being ashamed. And he even believes it.
Well, 2,000, Durand said. 2,000, he repeated.
It was as if he had said home, love, God, green asparagus, young partridges, old Saint-Emilion, gone.
Well, can we start now?
The man had a fat pot belly and thin arms and legs. Ravitch happened to know who he was. His name was Leval, and he was a high official whose department handled refugee matters. Weber had told him this as a special joke. Leval was a name known to every refugee in the Internationale. Ravitch made the first cut quickly. The skin opened like a book. He clipped it tight and looked at the yellowish fat which popped up.
"We'll take a few pounds off as a free gift. Then he can eat them on again," he said to Durand.
Durand did not answer. Ravitch removed the layers of fat in order to get close to the muscles. "There he lies now, the little god of the refugees," he thought. "The man who holds hundreds of little fates in his hand, in this whitish, swollen hand which lies here now lifeless. The man who had ordered the deportation of old Professor Meyer, who hadn't enough strength left to walk once more the road to Calvary, and who had simply hanged himself in a closet of the Hôtel Internationale the day before his deportation. In the closet, because there was no hook elsewhere. He could do it. He was so emaciated that a clothes hook was strong enough to hold him. Not much more than a bundle of clothes with a bit of strangled life inside. That was what the maid had found in the morning. If this potbelly had had mercy, Meyer would still be alive.
Clips, he said. Tampon.
He continued to cut. The precision of the sharp knife. The sensation of a clean incision. The abdominal cavity. The white coils of the intestines. The man who lay there with his belly opened up had his moral principles, too. He had felt human compassion for Meyer, but he had also felt something that he called his patriotic duty. There was always a screen behind which one could hide, a superior who in turn had his superior, orders, instructions, duties, commands, and finally the many-headed monster, morale, necessity, hard reality, responsibility, or whatever it was called. There was always a screen behind which to evade the simple law of humanity. There was the gallbladder, rotten and sick. Hundreds of Tornados Rossini have done this to him. Of tripe à la mode de Caen, of heavy canard pressé, pheasants, young chickens, fat sauces, together with bad temper and with thousands of pints of good Bordeaux wines. Professor Meyer had had no such worries. If one should blunder now, cut too far, cut too deep, then in a week would a better man sit in that stuffy room that smelled of files and moths, where trembling refugees awaited their life or death sentences? A better one? But maybe someone worse. This unconscious 60-year-old body here on the table under the bright lights undoubtedly considered himself humane. Surely he was a kind husband, a good father, but the minute he entered his office he was transformed into a tyrant hiding behind the phrases, "We can't do that," and "Where would it get us if," and so on. France would not have perished if Meyer had continued to eat his meagre meals. If the widow Rosenthal had been allowed to go on waiting for her dead son in a maid's room in the Internationale, if the tubercular dry-goods dealer Stallman had not been imprisoned for 6 months because of illegal entry, to be released only to die before he could be shipped across the border. Fine. The incision was fine, not too deep, not too wide. Catgut. The knot. The gallbladder. He showed it to Durand. It shone greasily in the white light. He threw it into the pail. Let's go on. Why did they sew with Reverdin in France? Out with the clip. The warm belly of an average official with a salary of 30 or 40,000 francs a year. How could he pay 10,000 for this operation? Where did he earn the rest? This pot belly had played marbles, too. That was a good stitch. Stitch after stitch. 2,000 francs was still written across Durand's face, although his pointed beard was hidden. It was in his eyes. 1,000 francs in each eye. Love spoils one's character. Would I otherwise have squeezed this rentier and shaken his faith in the divinely appointed world order of exploitation? Tomorrow he'll sit unctuously at this potbelly's bedside and accept grateful speeches for his work. Careful, there was one more clip. The potbelly means 1 week at Antibes for Joan and me. A week of light in the rain of ashes of our times, a blue piece of sky before the thunderstorm. Now the seam of the peritoneum. Especially fine for the 2,000 francs. I should sew it up with a pair of scissors inside in memory of Maya. The humming white light. Why does one think so disconnectedly? Newspapers, probably. Radio. The incessant rattling of liars and cowards. The lack of concentration through avalanches of words, confused brains, exposed to all the demagogic trash. No longer used to chewing the hard bread of knowledge, toothless brains, nonsense. So that's done now. There's still the flabby skin. In a few weeks he can again deport trembling refugees, if he doesn't die. But he won't. People like him die at 80, honoured, self-respecting, and with proud grandchildren. That's done with. The end. Take him away. Ravitch drew the gloves from his hands and the mask from his face. The high official glided out of the operating room on soundless wheels. Ravitch gazed after him. Laval, he thought, if you only knew that your thoroughly legal gallbladder had provided me, an illegal refugee, with a few highly illegal days on the Riviera. He began to wash. Beside him, Durand washed his hands slowly and methodically. The hands of an old man with high blood pressure. While carefully rubbing his fingers, he rhythmically chewed with his lower jaw, slowly and as if grinding corn. When he stopped rubbing, he also stopped chewing. As soon as he started again, the chewing began too. This time he washed particularly slowly and deliberately. He wants to keep the 2,000 francs a few minutes longer, Ravitch thought.
What are you still waiting for?
Durand asked after a while.
For your check. I'll send you the money as soon as the patient pays. That will be a few weeks after he is released from the hospital.
Durand began to dry his hands. Then he seized a bottle of Eau de Cologne d'Orsay and rubbed it on.
You have that much confidence in me, haven't you?
He asked. Cheat, Ravitch thought. Still wants to squeeze out a little humiliation.
You said the patient was a friend of yours who would only pay the expenses.
Yes, Durand replied unobligingly. Well, the expenses amount to a few francs for the materials and the nurses. You own the hospital. If you charge 100 francs for everything, you may deduct that and let me have it later.
The expenses, Dr. Ravitch, Durand declared, straightening up, are, I'm sorry to say, considerably higher than I had thought. The 2,000 francs for you are part of them. Therefore I must also charge the patient for that.
He sniffed the eau de cologne on his hands.
You see,
he smiled. His yellow teeth formed a lively contrast to his snow-white beard, as if someone had made water in the snow, Ravitch thought.
Nevertheless, he'll pay. Weber will give me the money on the strength of it. I won't do this old goat the favour of begging him for it now.
All right, he said. If it is so difficult for you, then send it later.
But it is not difficult for me. Although your demand came suddenly and as a surprise, it's for the sake of order.
All right, then we'll do it for the sake of order. It's all the same.
Which absolutely not the same.
The effect is the same, Ravitch said.
And now excuse me, I want to get a drink. Adieu.
Adieu, Durand said, surprised. Kate Hegstrom smiled. Why don't you come with me, Ravitch? She stood before him, slender, sure of herself, with long legs, her hands in the pockets of her coat. The forsythia must be in bloom by now in Fiesole. A yellow fire along the garden wall, a fireplace, books, peace. Outside, a truck thundered along the pavement. The glass frames of the pictures tinkled in the small reception room of the hospital. They were photographs of the Cathedral of Chartres. The quiet at night, far away from everything, Kate Hagstrom said. Wouldn't you love that?
Yes, but I couldn't stand it.
Why not?
Quiet is only good when one is quiet oneself.
I am not quiet myself.
You know what you want. That's almost the same thing.
Don't you know what you want?
I don't want anything.
Kate Hagstrom slowly buttoned her coat. Now what is that, Ravitch? Happiness or despair?
He smiled impatiently. Probably both. As always, both. One shouldn't think about it too much.
What else should one do?
Be happy. She looked at him.
One doesn't need anyone else for that, he said.
One always needs someone else for that.
He remained silent. What am I talking about? He thought. Travel chatter, goodbye embarrassment, mealy sermons.
Not for the little happinesses of which you once spoke, he said. They bloom everywhere like violets around burnt-down houses. One who doesn't expect anything will not be disappointed. That's a good basis. Then anything else that comes along adds a bit to it.
It's nothing at all, Kate Hagstrom replied. It only seems so when one lies in bed and thinks cautiously. Not any more when one can walk around. Then one loses it again. One wants more.
An oblique ray of light fell through the window across her face. It left her eyes in shadow. Just her mouth bloomed in it alone.
Do you know a doctor in Florence? Ravitch asked.
No. Do I need one?
There's always a chance some trifling matter may turn up afterwards. Anything. It would make me more comfortable to know that you have a doctor there.
I feel very well, and I'll come back if anything should happen.
Of course. This is just a precaution. There is a good physician in Florence, Professor Fiola. Will you remember that? Fiola?
I'll forget it. It isn't at all important, Ravitch.
I'll write him. He'll take care of you.
But why? There is nothing wrong with me.
Professional precaution, Kate, nothing else. I'll write to him to call you up.
If you like. She took her bag. Adieu, Ravitch. I'm leaving. Maybe I'll go right to Cannes from Florence, and from there to New York on the Conte di Savoia. If you happen to come to America, you'll find a woman in a country house with a husband and children and horses and dogs. I leave the Kate Hagstrom you've known here. She has a small grave in the Scheherazade. Have a drink over it now and then when you're there.
All right. With vodka.
Yes, with vodka.
She stood undecided in the dark of the room. Now the ray of light fell behind her on one of the photographs of Chartres, the high altar with the cross.
Strange, she said. I should be happy. I'm not.
That's true of every farewell, even farewell to despair.
She stood before him, hesitating, full of soft life, determined and a little sad.
The simplest thing when saying goodbye always is to go, Ravitch said. Come, I'll go out with you.
Yes.
The air was mild and humid. The sky hung above the roofs like glowing iron. I'll call a taxi, Kate.
No, I'll walk to the corner. I'll find one there. It's the first time I've been out.
How does it feel?
Like wine.
Don't you want me to call a cab for you?
No, I'll walk.
She looked down the wet street. Then she smiled.
In some corner there is a bit of fear left. Does that go with it, too?
Yes, that goes with it.
Adieu, Ravitch.
Adieu, Kate. She stood for another second, as though she wanted to say something. Then she walked down the stairs with careful steps, slender, still supple, along the street toward the violet-colored evening and toward her destruction. She did not turn back again. Ravitch went back.
As he passed the room which Kate Hegstrom had occupied, he heard music. Surprised, he stopped. He knew that there was no new patient there as yet. He cautiously opened the door and saw the nurse kneeling in front of a record player. She was startled when she heard Ravitch and got up.
The Victrola was playing an old record, La Dernière Valse. The girl smoothed her dress. "Miss Hegstrom gave me the Victrola as a present," she said. "It's an American make. One can't buy it here. Nowhere in Paris. It's the only one here. I was trying it out immediately. It plays 5 records automatically." She beamed with pride. "It's worth at least 3,000 francs, and all the records with it, there are 56. Besides, there is a radio built in. That's luck." Luck, Ravitch thought. Happiness. Again. Here it was a record player. He stopped and listened. The violin flew up from the orchestra like a dove, plaintive and sentimental. It was one of those languishing airs that sometimes touch our hearts more than all the nocturnes of Chopin. Ravitch looked around. The bed was stripped and the mattress put up. The laundry was piled by the door. The windows stood open. The evening stared into the room ironically. A fading scent of perfume and the dying strains of a waltz were what was left of Kate Hegstrom.
"I can't take everything with me at once," the nurse said. "It is too heavy. I'll take the Victrola along first, and then I'll come back twice and get the records. Maybe even 3 times. It's wonderful. One could open a cafe with it."
"A good idea," Ravitch said. "Be careful not to break anything."